All right, and that concludes tonight's reading. I will now turn it over to Lynn.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lynn, and I am an alcoholic. I came to Portland 10 years ago, and I had come from a 12-step rehab, which I spent 3.5 months in, going through the beginning of the book, reading, taking a third step, starting to write a fourth, finishing the fourth, really sure that I knew what the problem was and why I was drinking. And I came to Portland, and I was drunk in a very short time. I realized then that I had not done a thorough fourth step, that I had not surrendered to a higher power, that I did not believe I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable. I thought I just had to slow down a little. The fourth step I did was not a really honest and thorough one. I tried to see where I was in the wrong, but I don't think I really understood my own selfish, self-centered nature. I had always been a good person, I thought. I had raised a family. I had a career. I was nice to people. I helped elderly people. I gave to charities. I was always the one to volunteer to make stuff for a barbecue or something. And yet, that led me to believe that I was a helpful, caring person. And as the years went on and the situation got worse and worse, I started to feel more like a victim. And as I started feeling like a victim, and that nobody loved me, and that the world was just rotten to the core, drinking was a great way to escape. I drank because it made me feel good. I drank because I could forget what was bothering me. I drank because I could be the life of the party. At the end, I drank because I think I really wanted to die. But I had been raised a good Catholic, and I knew I couldn't kill myself. But when I look at it now, that's exactly what I was doing. I was trying to go to sleep and never wake up, because I just couldn't deal. I couldn't deal. My husband, ex-husband, didn't do what I wanted him to do. My kids were teenagers, and I don't even have to go into that. My job was stressful. There was never enough money, time, and I felt like I was victimized. So I drank. And at the end of my drinking, which probably went on a good 6 or 7 years, I was drinking 24/7. I was waking up and taking a drink because I was shaking so bad I couldn't get out of bed. I was going for lunch drinking at work. When I left work and drove home, my very first stop was the liquor store. And of course, I had 4 or 5 of them, because you couldn't go to the same one twice, because they knew me. And I thought they would never suspect if I only came once a week. Of course, how many people do you know are waiting outside the door at 8 o'clock in the morning when the liquor store opens? I never thought that was a red flag. But in the end, I was drinking all day, every day. And just like it says, and more about alcoholism, I was that person who had liquor hidden all over my house so that when my kids did find my stash and would angrily throw it down the kitchen sink, I knew there was another bottle hidden somewhere else. I was the guy who woke up in the middle of the night, always woke up at 3 in the morning, that wonderful witching hour, because I was suddenly awake and I needed a drink. I got to the point where I slept with a bottle of vodka under my pillow so I wouldn't even have to get out of bed. I don't know why my ex-husband never found it, but he never did. Maybe he was so disgusted with me at that point that he didn't even care, which is probably what it was. By the time I finally did go to that 12-step rehab 10 years ago, I was drinking every day. I had been to 4 or 5 rehabs. I had been to detox so many times that when I said goodbye, when I was leaving, the guy at the desk would say to me, "You'll be back." I remember how that used to piss me off. It's like, how dare he? How dare he imply that I can't do this? But, of course, I couldn't. I couldn't do it. Until I truly, truly decided I was going to do the work in this book and do it with a Big Book Step Study sponsor who was going to take me through it step by step and show me that I was indeed a selfish, self-centered individual. By the time I ended up in Portland, I was in the middle of a divorce. I had lost my house, my job, my car, very little money. My two daughters, who at this point were teenagers, didn't want to have anything to do with me. So I came to Portland, and I didn't know anyone. I lived in sober houses, hated them. Hated living with a bunch of women that I didn't know, most of them who were much younger than me. And I came to meetings. And this was one of the first rooms I ever went to a meeting to. There used to be a speaker meeting here on Friday night. Podium up there, the chairs here. And I used to sit in this meeting and I used to shake and cry. Oh, woe is me. Nobody loves me. Look at my life. I'm a wreck. I'm a 50-some-odd-year-old woman, and I'm a wreck. But my sponsor kept saying to me, you do this work, and you will come to know God, and you will get better. All the promises in this book will come true. But the first thing I had to do was admit to myself that I was powerless over alcohol. There was no middle of the road. There's no reservation that 10, 20 years, 50 years later, if I'm lucky enough to live that long, you'll be able to drink in safety, because I can't. As soon as I take alcohol in my body, it starts a craving that I never know where I'm going to end up. I remember hearing, as I'm sure all of you have heard, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. No, I used to think, hell, I can drink 10 before I get drunk. It wasn't until I started to understand that what they're saying is I take that first drink and it sets off that craving, that allergy, just like Dr. Silkwood talks about in step one. And I can't stop. Once it's gone and running, I'm with it. And I don't know whether I'll end up after 2 drinks going home and passing out, or as I did at the end, in a car accident, driving drunk and spending the night in jail. That's what happens when I take even one sip of alcohol. So if I'm powerless and alcohol makes my life unmanageable, my solution is don't drink. You don't drink, the allergy doesn't get set off. But I can't not drink. I had proven that for years. I mean, I'd been, like I said, the people in the detox knew me. That's how many times I'd been there. I couldn't not drink. So how do I deal with the mental obsession? And my sponsor told me that step 2, coming to believe that a power greater than myself Because by definition, if I'm powerless, I need to get power somewhere. I don't have it. I never did when it came to alcohol. So where do I get it? I have to start to believe that there's a power outside of me who loves me. And she told me that 50,000 times. God loves you. You are a child of God. Which I had a lot of trouble believing because I sure as hell didn't love me. And I didn't think anybody did. So she said, believe in a higher power and become willing to turn your life and your thoughts over to that higher power. Now, at this point, I didn't have a clue what that meant. How do you do that? What do you do? I didn't know what letting God run my life meant. I just knew without a doubt that me running my life was a shit show. It was a train wreck. And I had done a terrible job. Not only did I have an alcohol problem, but as I said, I lost everything that was important to me. I didn't care. Drinking was more important than my kids, than my family. I had to learn to love myself, to trust in God, and to do this work. So my sponsor said, you're going to take your resentments and turn them into patience, tolerance, and love. You're going to take your fear and turn it into courage. And you're going to take your guilt, shame, and remorse and turn it into right action. Again, I didn't know what that meant or how I went about doing that. She said, once you've taken step three and you know that you want help, what you do now is steps 4 through 9, where you do the work that's laid out in the big book. And she was there with me every step of the way. And I started writing my inventory, this time really answering those 4 questions, the resentment turnarounds. Where was I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid? Never mind what someone else had done to me. Never mind that I thought I was the victim. Never mind that I thought nothing ever went my way. What was I doing? How was I feeling? What was I thinking? What did I want? What lies was I telling myself? It took me almost 20 months to write my 4-step inventory because I didn't like it. I didn't like what I saw. I didn't like the person I had become. As I wrote, the more I really went into my own heart and thoughts, I started to see how selfish I really was, and that was hard to look at. I can't tell you how many times I slammed the notebook closed and said, that's it, I'm done, walked out of the room, called her on the phone and told her, I'm finished. And she was like, yeah. If you don't do this work, you're going to drink again. This is the only way to figure out. And I still didn't believe her. She used to say things to me like, wait till you get to the other side. And I used to think, is this like some science fiction thing? Am I going to end up on Mars? I mean, what other side is she talking about? But she kept saying, do it. Just keep moving forward. Put your one foot, then the next, and keep doing it. So I did the resentments, which was probably the most painstaking part of my inventory, in that it was really hard to look at. I mean, I felt awful about myself. There was no way to run away from it. It was there in black and white right in front of me. And then I did my fear inventory, and I was afraid of everything. And the dichotomy of I'm afraid to be married, I'm afraid to not be married, I'm afraid of love, I'm afraid of being alone, I'm afraid, you know, everything was I was always afraid of something because what I really wanted was for someone to tell me what to do. I want you to do this. I wanted to be told, taken care of. I wanted to feel better. I wanted someone to solve all my problems. And I had been running away from my own life, my whole life. I'd never really grown up. I was acting like a 50-year-old baby, is what I was doing. So I wrote down those fears, and I started to realize that 95% of my fears weren't even based in reality. I mean, yeah, I had real fears, like fears that something harm would come to my kids, or a fear that I would get a deadly disease or something. But most of my fears were in my imagination. I was afraid of what you were going to say about me. I was afraid you weren't going to like me. I was afraid that someone was going to laugh at me. And I started to think, I mean, I didn't know what other people thought. I didn't know how other people felt. I was running the whole acting, the whole stage show myself. You just had to watch as I, you know, fell apart. And then we came to this part of the inventory, what's called the sex part, or harms to others. You know, in the resentments, I looked at, it was easy to write resentments. What other people did to me, oh, and I had a long list of what I thought. And then the fear is fear. But this part of the inventory really opened my eyes, because this is what I did to other people. This wasn't resentment that somebody called me a name. This was my own behavior, my selfish, self-centered behavior, and how I treated not just men, but women, too. I wrote some things down in here, and this was 10 years ago when I wrote these. I wrote, I was never as nice to women as I was to men. I wanted someone to make me feel good, and if I flirted, men usually responded. It was all about my need, what I wanted, never about giving to the situation. I never even saw the women. And it was like, wow, I never had women friends. I had one or two here or there. And I remember lamenting about the fact that I didn't have women friends, but I started to realize that was my own fault. I was so focused on the fact that I could flirt, or I could get a guy to buy me a drink, or I could get someone to change my flat tire, or come to my apartment and fix something if I flirted, that I didn't even see the women in the room. So there were a lot of women I hurt with my behavior that I didn't even give the time of day, or was just downright bitchy to, because they happened to be in my way and I didn't really want to deal with them. So I had to look at that behavior. I had to look at behavior as simple as going into a bar and letting a guy buy me a drink, knowing full well what was on his mind, knowing I was never going to give him what he wanted, but it didn't matter. I got a free drink. I was using someone for my own purposes with no thought about their feelings or what they wanted. You know, drinking allowed me to do things I knew were wrong, but when I was drunk, I didn't care. And I did some not kind things to men when I was drunk. I mean, I didn't have a long, you got to remember, I'm a little older than you guys. Life was a little different back then. You had to be a little more discreet. But I still had my fair share of people that I went home with, guys that I slept with that I didn't know really who they were. I'd met them. They seemed cool. I wanted some attention. It was easy, especially if I was drunk. because then nothing stopped me. I mean, I think I only once had the experience of waking up and wondering where the hell I was, which was very scary. But never really thinking of the fact that I put myself in those positions. I used people to get what I wanted. And she told me that when I write this part of my inventory, you know, and I ask myself the questions, how was I inconsiderate? Whom did I hurt? It wasn't just, for instance, the guy that I happened to flirt with and go home with that night. What about his girlfriend? What about his sister, who is my friend? What about his kids? You know, it's like, I never thought. It was always, well, I'm lonely. Don't I have a right to love? Don't I have a right to fun? It was also selfish. You know, when she told me, my sponsor told me that you're going to take this guilt, shame, and remorse that you've been living with when you remember these things, and you're going to turn it into right action. You're going to stop doing these things. You're going to start behaving like a woman of honor and dignity. And you're going to be more considerate about other people, especially men. I have a partner now. I'm divorced and I have a partner now. And he's a wonderful guy. And I find myself sometimes thinking, you're not giving me what I want. You're not loving me enough. You never tell me how I look. And I feel this victimization of, no, here we go again. And I have to remember that this part of the inventory, all of the inventory, shows me patience, tolerance, and love for other people. It's not all about me, what I need and what I want. It's about them. And if somebody isn't, perhaps, giving me what I need, it's time to speak up and say something and not play the old woman game of ESP. He should know what I want. You know, that classic thing. So I wrote this inventory, this part especially, and I try now to live by what I've learned. You know, in step 6 and 7, we talk about our character defects. And I was very aware of what my character defects were from this inventory. They were staring me right in the face. And I had to really pray every day for God's help not to let those defects come back. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I get mad. You know, I sometimes yell at drivers. Out on the road there. But I try to really put myself in the other, the other person's position. My kids have really seen me change. This program is amazing. It really is, because my kids, who didn't want to have anything to do with me, call me every day. I'm involved in their lives. They live in Massachusetts, so I don't see them a lot. But they have accepted me back, because in the years that I've been making living amends to them, they have seen me change. They have seen me grow. They have seen me become a patient, tolerant person. My older daughter's getting married in 3 weeks, and I'm part of her wedding. I can't tell you what it meant to me when she said to me, Mom, you and Dad are going to walk me down the aisle. I started to cry. I mean, this is a kid who wouldn't even take my phone calls. And now I'm back in her life. And it is because of this program. It is because of doing the work. I tried to shortchange it when I first did it. I tried to take a shortcut. I thought, I don't need to be honest and thorough. I'll just write what I think. And it didn't work. It didn't work. I could not stay sober. But doing this work, believing in a higher power, and AA, these meetings, my sponsor, you know, it's funny, I watch this funny sitcom on TV. I don't know if anyone watches it. It's called Mom. And these two women are alcoholics, and they go to meetings in the sitcom, and they sit in basements, and they talk about how their days revolve around going to meetings. And I think, isn't that awesome that they're talking about this on television, that they're making it an okay thing to do? Because there's no reason that anybody should feel less than or feel like something's wrong with them because they're in these meetings. You're here because you need help. And this is the place to get it. Thank you.